Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are going to finish up our two-parter of Nisei and 731 with 731. You know, Jen, we decided last time that we just simply can't do a two-parter in one episode because quite literally we're going to be here all night and no one has the energy for that. Yeah, so apologies in advance if, as we get into this conversation, we make references to things that we might have already addressed in the last episode. But moving forward, this is going to be our new plan. So hopefully there won't be too much repeat. And you know what? It always helps me to listen and be reminded of things that happen. So, but anyway.
It's just how it happens. We can't remember what we say. I was saying before we started, I have like podcast amnesia. As soon as the podcast ends, no recollection of what happened. When I'm listening back to it in editing, it's like, wow, this is all very interesting. I don't remember any of this. I never know I was actually there. So it's always like listening anew. So yeah, there's a very good chance I'll say something that I've said before, but it just shows that we just stand by our positions.
It's true. I love it. And I also have the memory of a goldfish. So occasionally I forget things that I watched earlier today. So it happens. It happens to the best of us.
It does. My memory is not good.
Before we get into this discussion, we would like to read some tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay. Tweets of the week. These are in response to our latest mythology analysis episode, Nisei. Thanks everyone for sending your thoughts our way. From Monica File Fan, Monica says, I want to comment on how I love that there's a group of women banding together, supporting one another, and opening their arms to Scully when she's ready for them. I agree that CSM's obsession with Scully increases after her new chip is inserted and grows with his future plans. Great point on both those points, Monica. I really like what Monica says about the MUFON women as well, that they are like this really great sort of sisterhood of like being super supportive and super understanding at the same time. Mm-hmm. It makes their fate really sad, but they're awesome.
Yeah, I do like that. And it was a choice too, because obviously MUFON isn't just women. It's a bunch of different types of people. And I think they were also involved with some of the people from, I don't know, I'm trying to think of when we get to Memento Mori, we'll probably talk about the bigger MUFON stuff. But the idea that in this episode, it is all women and they clearly have some sort of support group among the women is really cool. And notable.
The abductees in particular.
Yeah, totally good.
And they all carry their chips around in case of chip emergencies.
I guess so. It's like a little talisman. I don't know.
Maybe it is. Maybe it's, you know, they have to show it to get into the club meeting or something like that. But I mean, it makes for a great shot in that episode, right? They're all pulling out their chips and Scully's
really
like,
does.
What the fuck? So
I
love it. I love the Allentown women.
It's this group's version of Walt Sent Me.
Exactly.
Their little code. I do also like what Monica said about the idea that the chip, I mean, people tend to forget about the chip in Scully, that it came out and then it went back in. And when it went back in, it came directly from Smoking Man, which sort of turns the control over to him. In my mind, at least. And I think it makes the most sense that way, which with actually where the story ends up leading. So I think that's really good to remind
and
people
I think
of.
It's an interesting sort of comment, just sort of a slight aside, on the issue of privacy, because I think that Scully knew that there were risks to putting that chip back in, because she knew what it could do.
Absolutely.
She had already learned by this time what those chips could be used for. Mm-hmm. And yet she knew that it was her only way to survive. So she has to give up a lot in order to have that chance to live. And it just, in a way, it's kind of an interesting commentary on our society today in a different way, because we are asked to give up privacy on many occasions, specifically online privacy. And a lot of us are just happy to make that trade. Mm-hmm. There's always that ongoing kind of issue of what am I willing to trade What am I willing to give people? What am I willing to give up in terms of privacy to get something that I want? And this is that issue taken to sort of almost an extreme. So it's an interesting development, and we'll get into that more as we continue on with the mythology. From Kathy G. Kathy says, I'm just rewatching, and I had a thought. When Penny Northern says, she is one, could that be a nod to Red Museum? He, she is one written on the victims, which Jillian Barber was also in. I think this is a really great point, Kathy. I had never thought of that before. Jillian Barber was indeed also in Red Museum. She played, I think it was Beth Kane. And yeah, that there is that sort of almost, it's almost like a tagline in that episode. He is one, she is one. And so it is interesting that she gets that line talking about Scully.
Yeah.
She is one. It does kind of make, it was it a little shout out? I don't know. It could be.
It totally could be. Obviously, she's not, you know, playing the same character, but then it makes me think, like, could she be? Is there another conspiracy going on here? It is a strange coincidence. Like, I definitely remember the She Is One being written on their backs. And I remember making that connection in the past in terms of, oh, it's kind of similar. But I never made a connection in terms of, like, plot. Like, I never really thought that there was any reason for it.
Right.
Because
yeah, I mean, as usual, there's two ways of looking at it. One is like out of universe, which is, you know, winky, winky, the writers are making a reference. But maybe is there something in universe that we could make of it?
Either way, it's a really good. And I hadn't made the connection before that, like, not only was there that connection between those two episodes, but the actress was in both of those.
Yeah. So I had not made that connection.
Yeah. So that was a really good, good discovery there.
That's a great point. And I love Jillian Barber. She's great in both of those episodes.
Yeah. Yep.
I love Penny Northern. Emily says, I would honestly love to hear more about the Senator and Matheson is a syndicate member headcanon. I've never thought of that, but it doesn't not make a certain amount of sense. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Annie? That was kind of, you introduced us to that headcanon.
I love that headcanon. You're not going to like this bit, but I kind of headcanon that is who, that Diana Fowley actually introduced him to Matheson. That's kind of my headcanon for that when they were back together. And not on purpose, but like he knew her first. And then when she was started getting recruited to the syndicate, this is all my speculation, by the way, that he then kind of transferred his attentions over to Mulder. I really liked that. I liked the idea behind that headcanon. So
I like that.
But again, it's just my own thoughts. I don't, you know, have it. I'm not basing that on anything, but I do like the idea. I like their relationship. It reminds me a little bit of Deep Throat, although I think Matheson is slightly less likely to risk his own skin for stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's very, very clear that he gets silenced at some point, and then he's much deeper involved, more deeply involved in this than we ever really get to see, which makes me think that he knows more than he is letting on. So, I actually think it's very plausible that he's a member of the syndicate.
I think, yeah, there's certainly I have no evidence to counter what you're saying. And as far as headcanons go, if there's nothing in canon to counter it, headcanon is valid.
Yeah.
So you go with it as far as I'm concerned. I'm not totally on board with it for solely personal reasons because I have a tiny crush on Senator Matheson and I want him to be a good guy. But
no, I don't.
Other than that,
I don't think he's a bad guy. I'm not saying that I think he's a bad guy.
Yeah,
I think
he's in the syndicate.
Yeah, but so was Will Manicured Man and so was Bill Mulder. And I think there are lots of double agents in the syndicate.
Right.
And I think that Matheson, if he was, is one of them. So
that's okay then, I guess.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting he's a bad guy. I'm just suggesting that he risked things to tell Mulder stuff. Mm. And then
he played both sides a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fair enough. Yeah. And I mean, that would make sense because where does he get all this information from? He seems extraordinarily well connected. So.
Exactly.
It's a pretty good explanation. I like it. I think I'm going to get on board with that headcanon. So thank you for explaining it a little bit more. From Pekka says, I am quite a new listener. Hi, Pekka. Welcome. But became addicted already. Mm-hmm. I am really appreciating the level of insight you are able to provide in every episode and fun insights and fun craziness. Thanks, Pekka. We enjoy the fun insights and the fun craziness around here. I feel like that should be like our new Twitter bio. Fun insights and fun craziness.
Yeah, I like it.
That's pretty much what we're going for.
It's pretty succinct. Yeah.
It's kind of, the craziness I feel like on my part just kind of happened. It wasn't necessarily an intentional direction to go in, but it turns out as soon as I start talking, fun craziness ensues. And it's just the way things worked out for us. And I think it worked out really well.
I enjoy the way things sort of spiral out of control at times over here.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't be serious all the time.
And we can't help ourselves. So.
No, exactly. The spiraling is kind of sometimes the most interesting bit. So that's life, though, right? Sometimes the spiraling parts of life are the most interesting parts. Mm-hmm. Little life lesson from Jen today.
Yes.
And speaking of people named Jen, Jen, spelled with a G this time. I don't know if I've met a Jen with a G, but I am pleased to. Jen with a G sent us a lovely message saying, I had to reach out and say your podcast is so amazing. I feel like you're the X-Files loving friends I desperately wanted when I fell in love with the show in middle school. I would try to show it at slumber parties and always get downvoted because it was too creepy. Yeah, I can kind of see that happening. Listening reminds me so much of searching the early internet for other people who loved Mulder and Scully as much as I did. The Field Where I Died episode of the pod was so cathartic. Jen, I clearly remember being devastated by the implication that Mulder and Scully weren't soulmates. And Annie, your analysis helped so much to salve that decades-old pain. I hear you, Jen. It's a joy and a pleasure to listen as I rewatch the series. You both rock. Thank you, Jen. That's a lovely. That was lovely.
That
was lovely for Jen to say that. And
thanks.
I got to say, yeah, Annie, you kind of salved my decades-old pain a little bit on The Field Where I Died, too. So you're just like, you're healing us all over the world.
I am here for you guys.
Appreciate it.
To make everyone like it a little bit better, that's my bag.
I'm kind of getting the impression that it's us old school files that really took it most to heart because mm-hmm. I guess because of the context in which we watched it, because we had so little shippy stuff to go on at that point.
Yeah.
So I think we needed it the most, and we appreciate it. We appreciate the different perspective that you brought. It's never going to be one of my favorite episodes, but I can think about it without immediately seizing with grief. So,
okay. Well, that's an important step to take.
I can see its appeal now, and I can see some of its benefits. So I appreciate all of that, and I appreciate everyone writing to us. Do please tweet at us anytime at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you on Twitter.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. After our very, very long discussion of Nisei, we are now ready to dive into 731.
Wee-hee!
And 731 is the number of the train, correct?
Is it? I'm trying to remember.
I'm pretty sure.
No, 731 is the name of the unit that...
You're right.
That these Japanese scientists originally came from. I had to think for a second. I'm like, is it? But there is a train number as well that has some significance.
Yeah, I am trying to remember why I thought that. But yeah, no, because I was thrown off for a second there. I was too. I apologize. Because last time when we were talking about the fact that the last part of the Anasazi three-parter was Paperclip, which was the German version of 731.
Right. And we had Napier's Constant.
Yeah. Okay, well, that doesn't really...
It's all about the numbers.
It was.
And since we're talking about numbers, the train car number is 82517, which, according to one source that I read, realized it adds up 8 plus 2 equals 10, 5 plus 1 plus 7 equals 13.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Well, that's not the first time that we're going to get that in this episode.
Yep. Absolutely, and Chris Carter loves to get 1013 in there wherever he can. And you know what? Do it. I love it because I like finding those little Easter eggs.
Every time it pops up, it makes me excited, but I did not do the math on that train car number, so well done.
I didn't either, actually. I think I read it on like Wikipedia or something, so thank you to whoever figured that out, because I knew that there must be some significance to it, because there always is, right, with numbers on the X-Files.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
glad someone figured that out.
Had to pick something, so I mean, it's got to always
be
1013.
And the camera always kind of lingered on that number, it seemed. So I thought, okay, we're definitely supposed to see that number. It's definitely got to mean something. So
can you imagine?
More than one thing, so who knows?
Can you imagine if that was a coincidence?
Yeah, that would be really like my mind would blow.
Yeah, but it's just funny to be like, okay, well, that was clearly something they put a lot of thought into, but like they can't do a fucking timeline. Like, come on, guys.
Honestly, they spent all this time coming up with secret meanings behind every number sequence on the X-Files.
Yeah.
But heaven forbid they'd figure out how long a pregnancy is meant to last.
Oh, I know. Oh, my God. Well, you know what? Don't get me started so early in this episode.
Yeah,
we will never, ever stop.
We're gonna stay focused here.
Let's head over to Perky. Which I enjoyed this city name because it was very city, town, region. I don't know. Because it seems Perky. Very, very oxymoronic to what is going yeah. on here in good old Perky, West Virginia. So we yeah. have what we find out later to be this leprosy compound, or at least that's mm-hmm. what is being claimed.
Yeah.
But it is all these... people who have been experimented on, essentially. I'm assuming that these people are essentially the types of experiments that wound up in that boxcar, or it could at least be a plausible explanation for that, because I think we're not maybe really supposed to know. It could be aliens, or it could just be people who have been horribly malformed by these experiments.
Exactly. It is a little unclear because there are some actual people there that had, what is it called? Hansen's disease, yeah. otherwise known as leprosy. I think like the people that are like hiding under the floor, those are actual people that had leprosy from what I gather and had just been living at the camp sort of, you know, for many years.
Yeah.
And then these other mysterious beings of unknown origin or identification started showing up, quote unquote, I think like a few years ago or something like that. And they're the ones that Dr. Zama was doing all these experiments on. And they,
yeah.
they have like burns. And so he's obviously doing some pretty nasty experiments on them.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that this is just kind of part of like a cover-up type situation. Like, we're going to do our experiments here so that yeah. everybody just thinks that this is the Hansen's disease research stuff
right.
that we're doing.
Yeah.
Which I think is really scary and really interesting, because it is one of those things that, you know, that they could, you know, the government could get away with, and they could get away with doing something like that. And it makes me think of like, we talked about Fight the Future, how, Kurzweil is telling Mulder that like they had this Hansa virus outbreak, like, and that was what they claimed that the black oil thing was. And it would
exactly.
just, it struck me as just like, okay, this is their policy. They just do this
yes.
as a matter of course. Like, if something is going on that they don't want, they're going to just say it's something else. And I find
and
that
people will just accept it.
People accept it, which we do all the time.
Yeah.
And
because it sounds, they always do it in a way that it's like a credible sort of cover up.
Yeah, exactly. And
because that actually was like a place where diseased people were. And
yeah.
so the fact that there were these other diseased people there would never have caught anyone's eye. And obviously it was the kind of place that was sort of off the grid and no one really cared about. And so they could kind of get away with things there. And the sort of fellow that Scully speaks to describes these other creatures as having, what does he say? They had the Hansen's deformities. I'm not quite
yeah.
sure exactly what he means by that, but it kind of, I think it's probably meant to raise questions in the mind of the viewer that maybe they were human and they were just diseased.
Right. And I think that's part of like the mystery of like, we don't really know what is going on here, but there are mm-hmm. a couple possibilities.
Exactly.
And I definitely think that it's humans being experimented on too, because, well, they say it outright, but I really wanted to bring up the fact that it very much mirrors what happens to Jeffrey Spender in season 9. Mm-hmm. His face and his scarring, when they have those little flashbacks of him in the chair
yeah.
getting those experiments, and you
yeah.
see like his skin kind of like bubbling up, you know, oh my God, Leia is here to.
Hi, Leia.
But you know what I'm talking about? I feel like
I
that is very, very in line with the symptoms. I should say the symptoms, the consequence, what we're visually seeing on these people's faces
mm-hmm.
from the results of these experiments, which is what Jeffrey Spender says happened to him. So I really liked that. I really liked that thread and how that follows all the way through.
Yeah. Very interesting connection there.
Yeah.
And I think that watching that scene, there's a fairly sort of, to me at least, a fairly obvious sort of connection being made with sort of concentration camps. It has that
mm-hmm.
kind of look about it. The people who live there are wearing similar kinds of clothes to people in concentration camps. And then we have kind of the mass graves So there is kind of a sort of vague reference connection being made to sort of the Holocaust as well.
Yeah, like
which happens on a pretty regular basis throughout the myth arc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the idea that these people are disposable, and anyone could be disposable is meant to be frightening, and it is. And I think that they kind of show that here really well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very chilling, isn't it? That special, like that opening sequence where they're, you know, executing those poor people and there's like this huge pit of victims. It's wow, it's intense. It's intense stuff.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder, this character Escalante, who we are kind of getting a lot of exposition from in this episode, he sees this, but it seems like maybe this is the first time he's seeing this occur. And
he's surprised, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I assume that he says he's been there for a long time, right? Like he and the other the people who were there for Hansen's disease or whatever. And it makes me feel so bad. We'll get there later, but when Scully shows up and she's like, y'all know that they cured that, right? And then they're all just still there, and that just makes me so sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. Those people are very sad people.
It's just it's just very, very I really like when the X-Files does this. They do a really good job of making you feel such empathy for these people that are victims of this insidious plot. I mean, it's Mulder and Scully a lot of the time, but most of the time it isn't. Most of the time it's just your random Joe, could be anybody, and they still do a really good job of making you feel for them. So I enjoy that.
They do. Yeah, it just kind of enhances the sort of level of evil from these plans that we see what the sort of evil results are. We don't just sort of hear about it in theory. We actually get to see it and get to know some of the people who are swept up in it. And that's an important part of feeling like this is an important thing to stop. And this is an important battle to fight.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I love this scene with Scully and X. I don't know why, but like they don't get to interact very much, but every time Scully and X have a scene together, I am just enjoying the shit out of it. I have to be honest.
Right? You're not wrong.
They're great. And I mean, I love her line in this scene when she says, "I don't have time for your convenient ignorance."
Yeah.
I really enjoy
that. Yeah. And you know what? She's bang on, because X is always like, "Oh, me, I couldn't possibly know that."
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, you know he's bullshitting, and she's got no time for it. Even after he takes her gun off her just like that, she's not thrown off. She keeps on grilling him. She doesn't care whether he's got her gun or not. She's gonna keep on going.
Yeah. And I think X like gets it. Like he's like, "All right, I know enough about you at this point that you're gonna just get the information that you need, and I understand." But it's funny. It's funny.
I think that they're just kind of like unlikely allies. Like they both sort of want to protect Mulder to a certain point, to different levels. But they both kind of want the same thing in this scene. But yet they're coming at it from obviously very different places. And they obviously occupy very different places in the overall scheme of things. But I always love it when kind of like people that would typically kind of be enemies are forced to kind of work together. Mm-hmm. And so it does make it for kind of a compelling sort of dynamic between them.
Yeah. And another thing I have to notice, even though you said all of that stuff that was very true and serious, every time I watch this scene, I can't not see that blooper of Jillian when she's trying to pull out her gun and she's like, "Don't you lie to me, you sack of shit," or she says something like that. And then she drops her gun and she's like, oops, can't say that. Like, I don't know. I always think of that blooper.
I know there's certain bloopers that once you see them, you can't unsee them.
You can't watch the show without seeing those bloopers, and then it kind of ruins the serious moment. But
it can kind of get in your head. So that I don't watch the bloopers a lot for that reason. Most of them I haven't seen as much as a lot of folks have, because it does kind of like, and I didn't see them for a long, long time. Like I never saw them back in the 90s. I only saw them in sort of the last few years. So I try not to think about them, but there are a few that like, like the pilot is another one where they're standing in the rain and Scully's trying to give her sort of brief monologue.
Yeah.
I can't not think about it there either. So
that one is epic.
But you know what? It's worth it, because those bloopers are gold. So
those bloopers,
it's fine. It's a price that I don't mind paying.
They're my serotonin. So I do watch them a lot, because they just make me so happy.
That.
Yeah.
We all need the serotonin.
I will take the random removal of myself from the episode. just for it's that okay. serotonin. So.
It's worth it. Totally worth it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, X and Scully together, hot. I mean, like, they both have so much chemistry that you put mm-hmm. them in a scene together. And it's not romantic chemistry, but there's just a lot crackling between
them. It's intense,
them.
Yeah. They're both very intense.
It's great. And, you know, there's like this big guy and he's just, you know, he's so tough and so authoritative. And there's little Scully, but you know what? She's going toe to toe with him. There's no sense that he's like bullying her or that she's even afraid of him.
She holds
She holds her own against him, which is not easy against X. So good for her. It's a great scene. And of course, X also presents like a new key to everything. There's always like one of those in every mythology series, usually more than one, in Scully's chip.
Yeah, he says, it holds more than I could ever tell you. Maybe all you need to know. And I think, I think that's a really important line. Because
it's a very important line.
The chip, I think, and I feel like I've probably mentioned this before, but I'll just mention it again. I think the chip is something that people tend to forget about because they don't mention it all the time. But just because the mentioning of the chip goes away, it doesn't mean the chip goes away. The chip is always there. The chip is always there to be analyzed and to be taken into account with anything going on, in especially particularly the myth arc. Even when they don't call attention to it, it's there. And I just think that's a really important thing to remember. And I think X is right. It holds more than I could ever tell you, meaning it holds what we'll find out later, all of Scully's knowledge, essentially. Maybe all you need to know. Yeah, it makes sense. And it was planted very early on here. And I like
that. No pun intended. Early on.
Nice.
Yeah, but no, I'm very into the chip. You know, it's anything to do with Scully's abduction. I'm very interested in it. And so I'm very interested in the chip.
Well, speaking of things that I'm very interested in.
Yes.
We have Mulder skulking around a train in a leather jacket.
Hello.
Don't mind that.
Not one bit.
Don't mind if I do. So this train operator guy, who I really enjoy.
The conductor.
Yeah, the conductor. We figured that out, right?
He's so great. I love the conductor. I'm a conductor stan. I'm just going to say that right off the top because I love him so much.
We need some more fanfic about the conductor and what he does in his day-to-day life. Where does
What did he do after this?
Was he found and executed because he knew too much or did he get away with it?
I certainly hope not. He just went about his very ordinary, otherwise very ordinary life with this whole strange tale. But I love how he's this ordinary guy who gets swept up in all this, but is very not fazed about it. Like, he's the guy I want to have around if there's like some kind of train emergency, because he keeps his head about him and he keeps his wits about him and isn't afraid to step up when necessary.
Right. And I mean, later when he sort of shuts the door and separates Mulder and the other guy from the rest of the train, you could look at that as like, oh, well, that was not very nice to Mulder. But I look at it as, okay, he's protecting his passengers, which should be his first concern anyway. And so quite an unsung hero here.
Yes. I mean, he is an unsung hero. And yes, I'll forgive him for sort of shutting that door because he just saved Mulder's life. So it's like, I saved your life. Now you're on your own, pal. I'm shutting the door. So that seems fair enough. He got Mulder to a point where he could defend himself at least.
Right.
And then he did what he had to do because he's the conductor. And he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I watched the episode, I kept waiting for him to turn out to be a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was almost like, there was just something almost too good to be true about him. Because you know how it goes.
You're expecting though.
You're just kind of expecting it sometimes. Like, you know, it's the X-Files paranoia thing that it'll turn out that this perfectly nice guy turns out to be someone who's, you know, part of the syndicate and he's going to turn on Mulder and mess things up for him. But no, I love the fact that he actually is just, you know, a helpful, friendly fellow. So thank goodness. Phew. So that I can properly stand the conductor and not feel bad about it.
Right. I mean, because they do definitely make it a point to give you some shots where he kind of is looking curious or he's, you know, the camera tracks in on him like, okay, wait, are we supposed to be afraid of this guy? So it is interesting.
Yeah.
They do.
It is.
And they do keep you guessing.
They do, which is great. I mean, it's just like you're just getting inside the world of the X-Files, right? Where you just never know who you can trust and who you can't. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned sort of the camera shots. I shout out to Rob Bowman, who's the director of this episode, because there's a lot of challenges with shooting on what is meant to be a moving train.
Yeah.
They had, you know, very tight quarters in terms of the sets they were using, and it could have been a not very visually exciting episode because, you know, it's very much happening for the most part in this one train car. But you know, Rob Bowman, I adore him. He just shoots things always in such an interesting and involving way that just contributes to the story and makes it more visually interesting at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think he does an amazing job with this episode, as he does with all of his episodes.
Absolutely. And we pointed out last time that this one and Nisei both have sort of different feels to them, and you can sort of tell by the directorial choices. So
definitely. And but, this one, 731 is just has the one writing credit, just Frank Spotnitz, whereas Nisei also has Chris Carter and Howard Gordon, I think, involved. But this one's all Frank.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, how can you go wrong? Frank Spotnitz writing and Rob Bowman directing. Boom. No wonder I like this episode so much.
Yeah, exactly.
Strong.
Well, Jen, we're coming into one of my favorite scenes of the entire episode, and that is Scully and Pendril.
Adorable.
Who we also probably talked about last time, but we're going to talk about him again because
we cannot get enough Pendril talk around here.
Seriously.
We don't get enough Pendril on the X-Files. So when he's on, we got to take it what we can.
I think we probably have already mentioned several times that these two are adorable together. And I would have liked to have seen more of them. I really would have.
Yeah. Very cute. Pendril is so adorable and very capable as well.
Mm-hmm. Very smart. He knows what's going on, and he anticipates what Scully needs, and he gets it for her. He's like, I knew you were going to ask for that, so I did it. And I'm just like, wow, they just work so well together. It's just such a nice, nice little, I don't want to say a change, because Pendril, I don't think, would be running away and jumping onto trains. But it's just such a nice little dynamic that they have going on, and I love it.
It's just like they're just clicking. They're clicking when they're together. And it probably, I mean, boy, that is really what Scully needs at that moment when everything is kind of going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
She needs a Pendril to kind of be there and just be solid, give her the information she needs, don't give her any shit. And he does all of those things. He's just very, very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. Everything about this scene is just, it's very engaging and very well shot, too. The way that they kind of get, again, Rob Bowman, shout out, the way that, like, as the information is getting more scary, like, you're getting kind of closer and closer in on them until, like, Scully is just straight up, like, practically biting her fingernails because it's, like, she is thinking of what Pendril is telling her as this is going on inside me, or this could have been going on inside me when this chip was in there.
Yeah, it's such an interesting sort of situation between two characters in a scene where Pendril thinks he's just talking about something in theory that I'm not sure exactly what story Scully has told him, but I'm sure it's not that it came from her. So he's just talking about this, you know, this theoretical chip that came from somewhere.
Yeah.
But Scully's talking about it from the point of view of this is what happened to me. And so it's an interesting sort of dichotomy of what's going on between them.
I think it's possible that she did tell him that it was in her because he mentions something about the neck. Like he does mention that this was placed at the neck. He says something like, you said this was at the base of the neck. So in theory, she could have told him that it was at the base of someone's neck, maybe not hers.
Yes.
Or she could have been like talking about the women in Allentown. You know, she could have said a number of these things, but he's obviously aware of the placement of it and where it was, because then that's where we get all of this information about what this chip is capable of and what it continues to be capable of throughout the series. Scully basically lays it out. I mean, she says you could know a person's every thought, which, as we learn later, is exactly what's sort of happening. I sort of headcanon that when Smoking Man saved her life, essentially, and gave Mulder the new chip, that sort of gave I mean, I'm talking about the cancer arc, obviously, that sort of gave him control over her from that moment in terms of him knowing her thoughts. And it makes me really think about some of the things he says to her when he has scenes alone with her in the subsequent seasons. And the fact that he sort of becomes, I would say, fascinated with her. Some might say enamored with her creepily. But he knows her more than she's aware. And I think, as creepy and gross as that is, I think it's also rather fascinating, the idea that somebody could know you more than you know yourself, essentially. And I feel like that's where we end up with Smoking Man and Scully. And this is never anything that is overtly stated. It is given to you piecemeal, like they do on The X-Files, little clues here and there that sort of tell you what all the things that you need to know, that at the end of the day, I think that absolutely that's what's going on here. And it's planted right here in season three, which I think is amazing.
It really is. This is almost the most we actually hear explained about the chip. We hear it's referenced on a regular basis throughout the rest of the series, but we don't often get a lot more information. This is about as much as I think as we learn about it. So this is a really, really important episode in terms of the whole rest of Scully's character arc, because the chip is, like you say, an important part of what happens to her. And so it's very significant discoveries. And yeah, there's just so many different aspects of how that chip figures in her experiences from there on out. And it's so fascinating to me, the whole idea of, I mean, at that point, she must be just so relieved that it's out of her neck, because the more she learns about what it could do, it's like, holy shit, this is what it was doing to me at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's only been a season since she's had it in her neck, so there's only been like a season's worth of that experience, but she's still horrified by it. But yet she winds up having to make the choice to put it back in just a season later. So it's the fact that she knows so much about it and still has to make that choice is really, really interesting.
It's terrifying.
And then she's stuck with it in there, knowing what it can do. Up until then, she didn't. She only quite recently found out it was there in the Blessing Way.
Right.
And she didn't know quite what it did right away. And now she knows, but, you know, at some point she'll have it in her neck and she'll know what it can do. And I can't imagine what that must have been like for her. So it's a very significant part of her story. And so that's it's not a huge part of this episode. I don't tend to think about that scene between Pendril and Scully when I think about 731. I just think about the train, to be honest. But it's really significant. So I'm glad we were able to chat about it.
Very significant. I remember because, when I was doing a rewatch of the whole mythology, I want to say like 3 years ago, I sat down and I watched every mythology episode just back to back. And I tried my hardest to focus and not be distracted by pretty David and Jillian.
Good for you.
And it was one of those kind of aha moments for me, this scene, because while I've obviously seen it, I don't think I ever truly absorbed it and its implications throughout the rest of the series and throughout the mythology, because I was also just kind of listening to how cute Pendril and Scully were being with each other, which is rather distracting. But there's so much, like you said, just so much important information in this sequence, and it's definitely worth people revisiting. Because like you said, I think this is the most we ever learned about the chip, and it is a lot. It's a lot.
There's a lot packed in there.
Yeah. So a great scene. And then of course we have to end with when Scully touches his arm and you see his face turn white. It's so precious. He's like, she touched me. It's so cute. And then and then he essentially has his classic line of, you keep it up yourself, or what is it? You keep it up yourself. Yeah. And then she walks away and he calls himself a doof. Which,
what a doof.
God, we needed more Pendril. I mean, honestly, I don't know how much I mean that when I say it, because I feel like these little tiny scenes are such gems, and maybe too much of him would have ruined it. But this scene is a gem. It's a gem.
He's just so cute, because, you know, I feel like Pendril is me. Like, if I were to encounter Agent Dana Scully, I feel like I would act exactly like Pendril and would be that big a doof. So
we all would, yes.
Yeah, so I love that about him. He's like, he's a Scully stan, and it's very cute. And he's so adorable about it.
Very relatable.
Because, I mean, like, Yeah, very relatable. I remember specifically thinking the first time I met an actor from The X-Files, it was when I met Mitch Pileggi, actually, at a con. And I remember I literally was thinking about Pendril's line as I was walking away. I was like, what a doof. Because I felt like I'd been exactly Pendril-like in my interactions, which Aww. Mitch Pileggi was very kind and sweet about it. But yeah, it's just that's a line that comes up in my life a few times.
I love it. I love it. And I mean, it's worth mentioning, too, because we're probably, I think it's in the episode Taliko, which I don't think we're ever going to end up talking about in any extensive way.
Yeah.
But there's a scene in there when Mulder is with Pendril and he's like, well, shouldn't we wait for Agent Scully? And he's like looking out or he says something and he's like, she's on a date or I don't know what he says. And he's like, breathe, Pendril. It was just very cute because I like the idea that like, The crush that Pendril has on Scully is basically like common knowledge. Like everybody knows about it. And I just think that's precious.
That's
even
so
Mulder.
Yeah.
It's just cute. I love it.
Yeah, he's adorable. They're adorable together. In another universe, I would have been happy with them together.
Yeah, I like that. Within another universe. Let's just go with that.
Yeah.
So this leads Scully to Perky. I was trying to figure out this connection. It's essentially the only like packing receipt or shipping receipt or something that he could bring up when he scanned the chip. Is that kind of
yes.
what this is? Okay.
Yes. He tracks the chip back to a Japanese manufacturer, right?
Yeah.
Yes. The chip came from a Japanese manufacturer. And
this was like the only place that he found that it was sending
yes.
mail to or whatever.
He's trying to find out, you know,
some connection. Yeah.
What connection, like how did this chip get here kind of thing. And so, you know, what's the source of how it came from Japan to here. And so he knew the manufacturer in Japan. He tried to trace whatever was coming from that manufacturer. And he traced something that was sent to this place in Perky, West Virginia. That's
right.
My understanding of it, at least.
Okay. Well, I mean, that was a very roundabout explanation, and I'm still confused. But I trust that the receipt is what leads her to Perky, which is good enough because
yes.
I know when we're picking apart
there's
these,
a receipt.
Yeah, there's a receipt or there's a packing slip or something.
There's
I don't know.
Something.
It's got the name of the place on it, Jen, and so
it's
that's how she found
it's
it.
Connected to the Japanese manufacturer in some way.
Yes.
And it's got the name of the place, and thus she goes to the place.
It's good enough for me. I know a lot of the time when we're picking apart these episodes that we're like, okay, especially with Nisei, I feel like that happened a lot. Okay, wait, why did they go here? What brought them here?
Yeah.
How did they end up there? And I do enjoy the fact that even if it's not necessarily easy to understand or explain, there,
yeah.
it is there. The answer
They're
is
trying.
There.
They're trying. Yeah, because there is a lot of like, from here to here to here to here in terms of, and you know, they wind up in, you know, some fairly sort of far flung places in their investigation.
Yeah.
And, but there is a connection there. It's not always easy to understand the connection mm-hmm. or to explain it on a podcast.
Right.
But it's there. They have made
there.
An effort.
They've made an effort. They've explained it.
Yeah. And it is good enough for me. I don't really care. You know, it's not a significant part of the story. It's just like Scully needs to get to Perky, West Virginia. We figure out a way to get her there. That's fine by me.
Yeah. And I do like the idea that this is where we hear the name Shiro Zama that is obviously going to end up being an important name for Scully later. It's just kind of a nice connection. I like
right.
that.
That's right.
So we're back on the train with Mulder. And I really like this little scene where he's like, trying to calm this family. I just wrote bless Mulder for trying to calm down this family. Like,
yeah.
They're like this
I think the mom literally says he's dead.
Yeah, the mom freaks out. I'm like that. Nice parenting, mom. Like your kid is right there, right? Like, geez.
And she just panics. She's in a panic.
She did definitely panic. I'm not judging her mom skills, but I just thought it was really funny how she's like, he's dead. Like, okay, we can think that. Do we have to scream that? But it was funny because Mulder's like, no. He's just a little motion sick. All right,
it's no biggie.
No big deal. Well, let's just go get him some water. I don't know. It was just cute. I like how he was.
See if we can find him a doctor.
Yeah.
Maybe you and the young man can find another restroom. And he's just switches like into dad Mulder mode, which
yeah.
I must say I always find very attractive.
It is even like unconsciously, it's total dad
yes.
Mulder mode, and I'm here for that. Here for it.
Totally. Ditto.
So we, I'm trying to, we go back and forth between the train and Scully for
Yeah,
so,
there's a lot of back and forth. Yeah.
But let's talk about this crew cut man for just a minute because.
Red haired man.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. You're right. Yeah. It's red haired.
But, you know, he has a crew cut as much as he has red hair. It's a completely meaningless title.
I'm calling him Piano Wire Man. Like I said, I like that better.
That's a much better name.
Because
Let's
that's the most
that.
Memorable thing about him. He's the Piano Wire Man.
I would never forget that about him.
Exactly. And I think that David, again, did some really good acting here, which is something I might have brought up last time, and I apologize if I did. But I really like the idea that he's grabbing his neck while he's because you feel that wire, like you feel it there, and that was just like, because that would hurt, my god. I don't even like I can't even imagine that would hurt.
It's good for him to remind us that, you know, this just happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's fighting through it here. It just makes it all feel real.
Yeah. I don't like the neck. And that makes me like,
no, so I bring up mine as we speak.
My question to you, Jen, and maybe this is an easy one, but like, is the red haired man essentially here on a suicide mission? Like, What's his goal here? Is he trying to blow up the train? Is he trying to abduct the little EBE or whatever's in there, the hybrid? Like, is he trying to just take it? Is he trying to, what's his end game here?
Good question. I think it's nothing about the mythology is an easy question for me, at least. My understanding is that it wasn't necessarily going to be a suicide mission. I think that he knew that there was a chance. I think he knew that there was a bomb on the train.
Mm-hmm.
I think for whatever reason, he seemed to know everything of Zama's plan.
Right.
That Zama's plan was to get this creature, I think, back to Japan.
So maybe stopping Zama was his...
I think stopping Zama was his overall plan, was to regain control of the creature.
Right.
I think his preference was not to blow up the train. I think that the bomb was there as Zama's failsafe, so that if he couldn't get the creature back to Japan, he would rather it had
been destroyed.
And red haired man, piano wire man, is trying to stop that from happening. So he's gotten to the point of getting Zama out of the picture. That stage is complete and correctly executed in more ways than one. And now his next part of the plan is to recover the creature without blowing up the train, preferably. But that turns out to be a sticky situation.
Okay. So it's almost like he's trying. Yeah. So once Mulder locks himself or gets locked in there with him, he's probably kind of resigned himself to the fact that, okay, well, now we're on plan B and I'm probably going to die in here mission, for the project with Mulder, which would be ideal for them probably.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering that in terms of like, okay, is he actually trying to get it out or is he on a suicide mission? You don't really hear about a lot of these syndicate members, like other than Michaud, who might very well in Fight the Future have been he was on a suicide mission, but it was never like the original plan.
Yeah.
He found himself in a position where he had to. And I feel like maybe like what you're saying is that that's essentially what Piano Wire Man is in right now.
Yeah. Because I certainly get the sense sort of from his performance that he doesn't want to die. And he's like very sort of nervous about Mulder accidentally setting off the bomb sort of early on,
right,
when he must still have some hope that they're going to find a way of getting out of there.
Yeah.
As it goes on, I think he starts to lose that hope and he's just kind of like, yeah, we're all going to die. But I think it seems pretty clear to me that he is very nervous about the bomb near the beginning, especially. So I don't think he's at peace with the idea of blowing up with the train, but I think he kind of gets there by the end.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So back with Scully for a little bit, she finds Escalante and the other, you know, people that are there. And I like the way that they did this scene because it's like they're telling her all of this. It's an interesting way. Like they don't I can tell on this show they really try not to do scenes like this where there's just a lot of exposition. But they handled it here, I think, really well in a compelling way, because you're hearing it from this character that you are having some empathy for. And we're all we're very closely paying attention. And I think Scully was the right one to have this conversation with. Like, I always wonder, too, like, not that Scully's going to be jumping on trains, but like the idea that like when they split up, because I feel like often in mythology episodes, they're split up and they're doing their own thing. I always wonder, like, what would this have gone like if like this were Mulder finding them and like having this conversation? Like, how would it have gone differently? I don't know. I always just wonder that.
Interesting question. Very interesting. But yeah, Scully's definitely the right person to receive that information and to make sense of it, I think.
Yeah. So he essentially is repeating... I don't want to say repeating, because he's giving us all the information that we really weren't aware of in the cold open. But returning us to that visual, and now us through Scully, we see that. Yes. And, you know, obviously she's remembering this, and this is something that she will recount to Mulder later. And this is all part of her coming up with this quote unquote fake story that she's going to try to sell to Mulder later unknowingly, even though it's not all fake, as we're going to find out. But I just find the way that she learns this and the way that she's sort of convinced of enough to be like, okay, we're after the wrong answer here. Like, there's something else going on. And I that makes the mythology so much more complex and confusing, but I also think it makes it so much more interesting when there's all these different options. Like, there's all these different possibilities of what the truth is. And I think that's what
Absolutely,
the show does great.
It makes it very plausible, really. There's, you know, the evidence that Scully sees throughout this episode seems very compelling. And so is the evidence that Mulder sees. And so I love the idea that both of them could potentially be true, that there isn't just one simple answer here. They always keep us guessing.
Yep. So Scully has, other than the well-manicured man, her first meeting with like a syndicate member here. And I think that this guy is clearly not out to help her. This guy is out to essentially, I think, just kind of fuck with Mulder. I feel like that's like, what's his game here? Like the first elder guy, the elder or whatever we call him.
First elder, I think, is the what he's
I think
called.
That's what he's called, is first
for
elder.
Whatever reason. I don't know who the second and third elder is, but he's the first one.
He's the biggest. I always kind of see him as one of the more head honcho-iest of the syndicate. Yeah. Like, cause he's always the one who's like, shut up, everybody. We need to focus. Yeah. Or he'll say something like
that. Always seems like the boss to me. He has kind of a godfather vibe about him.
Yep, definitely. And I'm sure that that's intentional.
It is kind of weird seeing him just suddenly like showing up on the scene and talking to Scully, because usually we only see him in like smoke-filled rooms.
Right. And again, that's like, we're not used to seeing that. It's very jarring. So we're thinking, okay, well, he's obviously going to be telling her some interesting information, but is it going to be the truth? Is it going to be a lie? And then as we see Scully walking through this train car, we start to think, okay, well, he's giving her enough of the truth to make her believe, because I absolutely do think, I think Scully was taken aboard a train car just like this and operated on by the Japanese doctors. I really think that that is what happened to her. And she's clearly having memories of it, and she's having some sort of flashbacks about it too. Like, she was so sure that she knew that guy. Like, she's like, nope, that's not where I know him from. And the fact that she's so certain about something like that, and it's Scully, just makes me think that, okay, she was in the perfect position to buy this story. So it was half truth and half just more lies to just fuck with them, you know. But at the end of the day, I think Scully just really wants to save Mulder. Like, I really think she just wants to make sure that he isn't going to get blown up, which can we blame her? That's her biggest priority here.
Yeah, that's a pretty important goal for her. I mean, she's got a lot going on in this episode. She's got a lot on her plate. She's visiting this weird medical camp. She's having this sort of like wowza conversation with the First Elder. She's going to this train car, and at the same time, she's trying to save Mulder.
Yeah.
So she is a busy, busy woman. She's got a lot on her mind. I admire her multitasking.
And she, yeah, like you said, she's doing a lot and she's learning a lot. Like, we're getting a lot of information. And I mean, I'm sure Scully at this point is just sort of trying to parse it out too and decide what's true. But yeah, like I said, at this point, I think she is just trying to convince. I think she always wants to convince Mulder that, like, just like stop, like give up, stop. Like, but at the same time, like she doesn't want him to blow up, obviously.
Yeah. But so, no, she feels like she's learning a lot.
Mm-hmm. And she thinks she knows it. Like, she's like, I've found it. This is the truth. Like, this makes more sense. The fact that, like, something is going on here, but it's not what you think. And I just like that, because then it makes us wonder, wait, is this really not what we think?
And it matches, you know, the other things that she herself has kind of recalled as well. So there's enough that she can remember that goes with what they're showing her to make it seem real. And as Deep Throat said, a lie is most conveniently hidden between two truths. And that certainly is at work here.
Yes.
The challenge of the viewers to figure out what's the lie and what's the truth. And it's certainly not always obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really well-placed quote there, Jen. Nice.
Thanks.
Job. Love it.
I was pleased. I feel like I really blew the explanation about how Scully wound up at Perky. So I'm trying to make up for it now.
That was really good. I liked it.
Thank you.
I do like that Deep Throat quote. So that was a very good way to bring that in there. I did like one of the things that the First Elder says to Scully, which was the ruler of the world is no longer the one with the bravest soldiers, but the greatest scientists. Mm. And I thought that was probably very interesting and frightening to hear in the 90s. And now it's like we've reached the point where people are like no longer believing in science. And so that's even more terrifying.
Yeah. Is the X-Files to blame? Who knows? Scientists are often very dodgy on the X-Files.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I
except for Scully, obviously.
Right. I just am saying it's like, man, how far we have fallen. That's what that was.
How far we have fallen. It is true. It just there is a lot of when you're watching the X-Files that does really tell you about how the worldview of the average person has changed so much since the 90s, and who is perceived as being credible and who is not, and all that sort of thing. So you have to, you have to kind of remember what the context was when this was happening. And at the time, scientists were, like, you know, considered very, very believable authorities.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to think that they're up to bad things is very frightening.
So Scully is calling Mulder again from a train, and again, crystal clear reception. just had to point that out.
A moving train, no less.
Both of them. She's in a train and he's in a train, and crystal clear.
Beautifully done. Yeah. Wonderful. I mean, who knew cell phone coverage was so good in the '90s?
I do like the idea though, that later in this scene, Mulder has to sort of fake that they have a bad connection, because I'm like, I mean, that was such an active decision on their part to be like, okay, well, we can't just have them have a bad connection, because we want Mulder to be like, no, I don't want to hear this. Like, so it was just, it was a very, very thoughtful thing, I think, to make sure that, like, oh, we're faking the connection. But I just find that really funny, and when there really should just be a shitty connection.
It makes sense in the story for him to decide that.
And
I love the conversation starts between them, because Mulder's handed a phone from Piano Wire Guy. Scully is handed a phone from the First Elder. So they're on borrowed phones.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, just this very weird scenario. Mulder has no clue who could possibly be on that phone. So the fact that it's Scully must have been very surprising. And yet she still just says, Mulder, it's me. And he still knows right away who that is. Normally she's saying that and he kind of half expects it to be her anyway. In this case, he must have been like, holy shit, it's Scully. But I just love the fact that she still just says, Mulder, it's me. And that knowing that he will still know exactly who it is.
Yeah. And he's probably like, how do you get the Piano Wire Guy's number? What's going on between you guys? What's up with that? Why are you calling this number?
It's just a very strange situation. Yeah. But but it's just them. As soon as they're on the phone with each other, no matter whose phone they got it from, it's just them.
It doesn't matter, because Mulder, it's me. And I enjoy that.
I love that.
I had a question for you, and maybe you can help me with. Scully says something about like the president having given a public apology.
All right.
For what was she talking about? Because I feel like what yeah. That would just seem like such a strange line to throw in when this is clearly something that like they just found out, and clearly this is not something the world has found out. So what is the president issuing a public apology about? I don't, that line, it really kind of confused me. It threw me.
It's a little confusing, that whole sort of exchange. I find a bit confusing. So Scully says, because I have what I told you I needed, Mulder, proof. And then she says, 2 weeks ago, the president made a public apology for secret radiation tests that had been conducted on innocent civilians up until 1974. So I guess so what Scully's saying here is the president admitted to the tests that I just saw were being done in Perky, West Virginia, mm-hmm. except as Scully says, guess what? And Mulder finishes her thought, those tests never ended. So I guess the point being...
But did the elder tell her that?
I don't think so, because it's a public apology that she refers to. She calls it a public apology.
No, was she... That just seems like something that would have been on their radar already if this happened 2 weeks ago, because I feel like that's something that like...
You would kind of think so. I mean, obviously the public apology was that it had only gone on until 1974. But, you know, bear in mind, that's still only like 20 odd years earlier than the time in which this is occurring.
Yeah.
So you would think they might have been a little bit more aware of, hey, radiation experiments being done in innocent civilians, that might somehow be connected to this event. But she doesn't seem to think of it until she's already had this conversation with the first elder, although she's obviously aware that this apology happened. And she also refers to in the context of having proof. I'm still not sure what she means by proof, because she says she has proof, and then she talks about the apology from the president. And then I guess the proof maybe came from the first elder, like you say, that the tests were still going on, the fact that she had seen the
proof
camp for
would
herself
have been,
maybe was the proof.
Yeah, I think maybe the proof was that she had seen that this was still happening. And she saw people killed, right? Like, didn't the firing squad return? So she knew all this, but it's just, I think the throwing in of that public apology 2 weeks ago thing just really... Yeah. I feel like it was unnecessary. Like that could have been something that they put in the last scene when they're just sort of like, you know, recon, like not recon. That's
them. They bring it up again in the last scene. So that could have easily been the only time they discussed it.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, Mulder's on a train that's going to blow up. We don't necessarily have to get into what the political situation is exactly right now.
Well, I mean,
and it seems almost like, because the little tagline at the start of the episode, instead of, you know, the truth is out there, we get apology is policy.
Yeah.
Which I always have a little bit of a struggle getting my head around that as being such a significant concept to this episode that it belongs in the tagline. I feel like they try to sort of almost wedge it into the episode in a few places, in this place, and then at the end again. But it doesn't feel like it fits in necessarily with what else is happening in the episode. So
yeah,
you on that aspect of it.
It's like they didn't make enough of a big deal about that. I know what you're saying. Yeah. It's in, and it's almost like they threw it in here to make it seem like we're dealing with this more than we actually do. Because like, I would have been really interested to hear more about this sort of apology is policy stuff, because they just barely touched on it.
Feels almost like something that was sort of like rewritten last minute and like, oh, we need to mention apology more often. I've decided I want that to be the theme, but they just kind of stuck it in a couple of places, and it doesn't seem to really go with what else is happening. But for some reason, apology is policy is suddenly the whole idea behind the episode, which I don't really get out of this episode necessarily.
No.
So it does feel a little bit forced as a concept.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad we brought that up because I that kind of confused me. And I, again, the apology is policy. Like, I'm not super attached to that in terms of like one of our great taglines that we get.
No.
Because I see what they're trying to do. I mean, the idea of these cover ups happening and then we get an apology and then everybody moves on. And
yeah.
I think that that is such a cool concept, but I don't. Yeah, like you said, I just don't see that being delved into here necessarily.
Not really. No.
So
not
yeah.
Not enough to change the tagline.
Exactly.
Come on.
Not enough. I would have liked more of that.
They could have put the train number or something in that tagline and it would have made more sense to me.
Yeah. Exactly. Or not change it at all. I don't know.
Yeah.
It kind of made me think of stop trying to make fetch happen. Like, it was like, oh, they're
yeah.
You know, like, if it's a very Mean Girls thing, like, why are you trying to make this happen? Apologies, policy is not happening.
It's not happening. It's just, it's not organically told through the story. It just feels like it's just forced into the script in a couple of places.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
Not a big nitpick, but just the minor one.
It always has bugged me a little bit, though. I always felt like, am I missing something? Because I feel like I should be getting this, and I don't really. So I'm glad that you kind of agree on that. So I don't feel quite like I'm missing something as much now.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have essentially, okay, this whole sequence is actually very, very exciting and it's very, very well done, but it's essentially just Mulder trying to figure out how to disarm the bomb. Like, that's essentially what our focus is right now.
Right. Yeah.
I do love the moment where he threatens to shoot the piano wire man's junk.
I didn't get that for the longest time. You know, I kept, when he makes this whole, when I miss, I tend to miss low. For the longest time, thought he was just referring to like, I miss low and I'll accidentally shoot you in the stomach. But I think it was just last night, having watched this episode for, I don't know, the seventh time or something. And I'm like, oh, when he says miss low, he means lower than the stomach. Now I get why he says it in such a kind of weird way. He's making this kind of like,
yeah,
very threatening kind of statement. And like, oh, okay.
Mulder and or David is not going to pass up a dick joke. And we love him for it.
Right? I know. It makes total sense. Now that I finally figured it out, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, now I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I did enjoy that bit because it was a bit that I kind of forgot about. Like, I didn't even remember it, but it was pretty funny and I enjoyed it.
I just like, come on, dude, is this really the time? But it's always the time when you're Mulder.
Right. So there, do you have anything really more to say about this train sequence up before X shows up? Because I have some stuff.
I find it. I do find it kind of interesting. The sort of change, sort of the fluid relationship, shall we say, between Mulder and Piano Wire Guy. That, you know, obviously there's a lot of tension between them, and yet at times they seem like allies because they're both trying to figure out how to get off that train, and also that Mulder eventually starts to treat Piano Wire Guy as one of his informants, essentially, and is just like, can't wait to hear everything that Piano Wire Guy is feeding to him.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, Piano Wire Guy is like telling him a few things and Mulder just filling in all the blanks.
Yep.
Oh, you're talking about an alien human hybrid. It's like, oh, Mulder, slow down, Brownie. He didn't actually get into all that. But it's, you know, typical Mulder and typical kind of syndicate, like, you know, just giving him little crumbs and letting him figure out whatever he wants to from that.
Right.
And so it's an interesting sort of interaction between them. Because, you know, Mulder will go from like holding the gun on him one second to like practically sitting down on the floor with him the next second. So
yeah, just being really excited to have a conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, ooh, tell me more.
Yeah. 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 It's
so, it's very interesting and well played as well.
He's just very excited to be figuring it out. I like that because that carries on. That made me think of the scene in My Struggle One when he's talking to that doctor, which is, I don't actually really like that scene very much at all, but like the doctor does say like, oh, well, you're almost there. And he keeps telling him like, yeah, just keep spinning your wheels, Mulder. You'll get there. And that's kind of what's going on here. It's like at this point, he's like, I don't really care what he comes up with as long as we stall long enough.
Yeah, really,
but yeah,
it's, Yeah, it's just, it's a classic sort of scene of all Mulder ever wants is information. And if someone acts like they have it, mm-hmm. he will believe them so quickly.
Yep.
And, you know, if I was ever in a situation in some other world where Agent Fox Mulder had a gun on me, I would just claim to know something, come up with a believable lie, and suddenly he puts the gun away and we're best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
It works every time.
You are right about that. I wanted to point this out too because I thought this was really funny because Scully's obviously on the phone with Mulder again as she's driving back to his apartment.
Yes.
But I would have really loved to see the scene where she and the Elder part ways. I just
we don't really see that.
I want to know how that happened. Like, I want to know if she was just like, "All right, catch you later." Like. How did that happen? How did she?
Because we see when they meet.
Yes, exactly. And then
so
like...
it would be just for closure. How did that wind up ending? Like, did she? Because we see her interactions with X. We know what she thinks of X.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really see much of her interactions with the first Elder. We see
no.
just a tiny bit when they first meet. The rest of it is basically Scully on the phone to Mulder. So we don't really. I don't get a really strong sense of exactly what their relationship was. She seems to be buying everything he's selling her.
Exactly.
Though, so
exactly.
It doesn't seem to be like a lot of tension between them at all. So she seems to be treating him as the source of all wisdom. So I don't know if they were like sort of uneasy allies or how exactly that sort of relationship went. So I would like to have seen that too.
It makes sense to me after her experience with the well-manicured man and sort of knowing that in the end he did end up telling her some information that was valuable. Maybe she's thinking, okay, well, clearly this guy is powerful and he's trouble, but he is also very knowledgeable and he's probably telling me stuff. And I, since I can line it up with my own experience, then it must be true.
Yeah.
But I just think the idea of how that goodbye would have gone finds me. It's just tickles me. I bet you what happened was he sort of said, good day, Miss Scully. And then just like disappeared into the shadows. And then she was just sort of left with a, where's my fucking car? Where are my keys? God damn it. Now I got to go stop Mulder from getting blown up. Like,
okay, I guess that's over. Now on to the next task.
On to the next task. I don't know. I just find that little transition scene, I thought that would have been entertaining.
That would have been fun, actually. Kind of like, how did it end?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're right. Probably just as formally as it began.
And mysteriously as he arrived.
Yeah.
He was then gone.
Just gone. And she's like, oh, okay, I guess that's that then.
Peace out.
I guess on to my next task.
So she gets to Mulder's apartment, which I think is funny. She just goes straight to Mulder's apartment because she's looking for his alien autopsy video.
Also looking for like his contact information for like, I think, Senator Matheson. And
She's
trying to get a hold of X. She's like looking through his desk, looking for various things.
Exhausting all of her resources.
And I love the fact that she just knows exactly who Mulder's sort of special contacts are and knows how to get a hold of them somehow and just goes for it. She just does everything that Mulder would normally do. She's very good at being Mulder when she has to be.
Yeah. And it's always funny to me, like how we don't really ever see when and how Scully finds out about these contacts, because we know that there are certain moments where she doesn't know. Like, for example, he meets Marita, I think, in Herrenvoke, but by the time we get around to Tunguska Terma, it's clear that Scully isn't aware of who Marita is, that he is asking her to find this person. I need to talk to this person. It's just
Mulder
interesting.
Mulder varies a lot in terms of how much he tells Scully about his informants.
Yeah. And I think that is about, you know, protecting his sources as much as it is about protecting Scully. I refuse to believe that this is like a, you know, quote unquote selfish Mulder kind of thing. But I, you know, who knows? It could be a combination of all those things. I wrote here, though, when Scully's like shoving around all the stuff on his desk, I wrote, Scully is not very kind to Mulder's things, but he deserved it.
That's what happens when you jump on a train, dude.
And then hang up on you.
Yeah, she does kind of like move all the stuff out of the way just to be able to put the X on the window.
And she just shoves it kind of angrily. And I'm like, she's probably like, fucking Mulder.
God, didn't need to do that. Like, Mulder doesn't have to move his stuff to be able to put the X on the window. Why does Scully have to do it?
She's very frustrated with him. She's just taking down her frustration.
She's in crisis mode. So it's like, get the fuck out of my way. I have to put the X on the window. So she's not going to be slowed down by anything.
It's just funny because it is, if you watch it, I rolled it back a couple times because it is very unnecessary how hard she pushes his stuff off the desk.
It really is.
I think there's
it adds to the drama.
It does, but I think there's a little pent up anger there too.
There is. She's had a hell of a day.
She really has. She really has. So she's able to then use this video to help him unlock the code. And I do like his joke when he's like, oh, so am I going to get my $29.95 worth after all? I thought that was a very nice callback.
And he's so happy, too. It's like, you know, it's a joke, but it's the truth as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, clever Scully for, you know, watching the video and figuring this all out.
It reminds me very much of the moment in Fight the Future, again, when he's stuck in with the vending machine and he's talking to her on the phone and he's just kind of like, all right, you know that face, I'm making it again. Like he's trying to use humor to make everything not seem so tense. And I feel like that was another example of that here.
Yeah, that's his sort of modus operandi when he's trying to keep his cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can't panic in that situation that he's in. He's got to keep his cool. And that's how he does it. So Scully knows that. She rolls with it.
I
do love it when she's watching the video and there's just like that frame by frame advance and I'm like, oh, I forgot about that.
Yep.
You know, frame by frame advance. I used to do that on my X-Files tapes a whole lot.
And the fact that she had to like rewind with the rewind button and then pause and then click, click. Yeah. Oh, we all remember that, man. And now you could just pull up a thing and shuttle through it by frame like with your arrow keys. Yeah, no more. Couldn't do that.
Yeah, and like, you know, like the little sort of like flickering on the screen and everything, it was definitely a little trip down memory lane, but good for her for figuring it out. Although it doesn't necessarily save the day in the end, it kind of sort of does, but I'm giving all the credit to Scully anyway.
It sort of it buys him some time, I would say.
It does, and that's important.
But I wanted to make a point to talk about this phone call between them where Scully is being very, very calm when she's trying to figure this out. And Mulder's being very calm too, even though a couple times he's like, okay, tick, 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 tick. Like, okay, you got to hurry up. And it was a very, very healthy conversation because I feel like in any sort of married couple situation, she would be like, shut up, I'm doing it. Like, you getting on my case is not going to make me go any faster, Mulder. But she's...
And he'd be like... One as in 1-1, or are you just repeating the same one, or are you saying 1-1? Like, what is it?
Yeah, their communication here is top notch, especially
really
considering it's them. I was very impressed with this
they've always worked really well together. As long as they're not discussing themselves their lives or their relationship, they're really great at communicating. And this is an excellent example of it. They just kind of, you know, and I love that line where Scully says to Mulder, I've got 6 minutes left. Like, according to my time, I've got 6 minutes left. And she says something like, you know, and is that what you have? And he says, I hope not, which is, you know, a clever little twist. Like, I hope I don't have 6 minutes left to live.
Right.
It's just clever. Just, you know, they're little back and forth during that whole conversation. It's great.
It's just nice. Yeah. You don't realize you're getting Mulder and Scully banter when it's working really well sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, it's just very natural.
It's very natural and it just works and it just fits them and fits the situation, even though, you know, it's this incredibly tense situation.
Yeah.
It's just that's Mulder and Scully, and it always makes it entertaining to watch.
Yep. We have again 10-13 and then 3-1, I guess, just to give it six digits. I'm not sure what 3-1 means, but I'm sure it has a meaning.
Yeah, no, I don't know either, but I'm sure it means something.
But as soon as she was like 1-0, I was like, oh, okay. I know the code. Why did you have
we
to?
Know the code.
You don't have to drive all the way back to Mulder's apartment. We already know it. but it was funny.
But it was so tricky, and Scully's trying to be definitive, but you could just see her just kind of like cringing, like, God, I hope I have this right. Yeah. It's just, oh, it's very tense.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I love her certainty, and whether she's actually certain or not, in her mind, she's sort of weighing the option. She's like, I need to be certain because if I'm not certain, like, he's going to die anyway. So yeah.
This is our best chance.
Yeah. And I like that.
He's got to do it. So I've got to sell this to him. Yeah. So I'm going to do this.
Yep. Yep.
She just like steps up and does what she has to do, and she gets it right.
Mm-hmm. And right as he's about to do the little button thing, although he does hit it, right? I'm trying to remember. He hits the code and it unlocks.
It unlocks.
Yeah. And then, the guy
has like a half second to be happy.
Yeah. He's like, oh my God, we got it. And then no, too late. My question was going to be, how did this guy get free? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering the same thing.
Because suddenly, like, we see him, Mulder's like on the phone, he's super excited, and then bam, that guy's right behind him. And I'm like, I thought that guy was like tied up. Like, do we not have to know how he got free?
Was he tied up, though, now that I'm thinking about it? Or was he just being held at gunpoint the whole time, and that's how Mulder controlled him?
Yeah,
and
he
got distracted
while
he was putting the code in.
And he was sitting there.
And just kind of forgot about
him. And the guy was probably just waiting for him to punch in the code. He's like, well, she's going to get the code, so might as well just use him. He's very distracted.
He used him and his very smart girlfriend to get the door open and then whacked him over the head. It was very unfair.
Yeah, it was very unfair, but also smart. Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the way that a guy like him, it's all about self preservation.
You got to play dirty. And so.
But no, he gets what's coming to him.
This whole thing is so. I don't remember. I mean, maybe you do, like the first time you watched this. Like, were you expecting X to show up, or did you think that, like, that was the last of him that we saw earlier in this episode? Like, do you have any recollection?
I was shocked when he showed up. I still am. Watch it. And the way they film it, it is meant to be like this kind of cool reveal, because we only see kind of like his legs at the beginning as he's kind of stepping over piano wire guy. And then all of a sudden it pans up and there's his face. So it was always a surprise to me, because I mean, like, I figured that was it for him in the episode. It was, I just assumed it was just going to be some kind of like generic who knows what kind of bad guy, and who knows what he was there for,
or the train conductor back to save the day,
possibly. Could have been the train conductor. I would have loved that ending, but I was like, this is not necessarily good for Mulder. Now there's some guy showing up shooting people, so who knows what's going to happen next,
right?
So yeah, the fact that it was X was a huge surprise.
Yeah, I love that. And I do love that he just steps over him. I think that's
steps over him.
It's such a cool introduction, because I feel like you know that it's him just by that. But just by that, because it's such an X thing to do.
It's a very X thing to do. It's totally believable looking at it now, that's for sure.
How many times, by the way, does X save Mulder's life?
A few.
Several, right?
Like reluctantly and sort of churlishly. Yeah. But I mean, there's definitely a few, and this is certainly one of the more, because there's no way Mulder would have survived if not for X.
I mean, I don't know. He did survive another burning boxcar a mere few episodes ago.
Never say never when it comes to Mulder.
Exactly.
But what I'm a little confused about is, what exactly was X's purpose there?
I think he wanted to save them both. Like,
Was he there of his own volition, because he knew that this was going down because of his conversation with Scully at the beginning of the episode? And so he was just, you know, doing his own, you know, back channels thing, and he figured out where the train car was, and he went there to do something helpful to Mulder. Or is it possible that he was the guy sent by the syndicate to, I don't know, take care of Mulder.
I think to retrieve the creature.
Retrieve the creatures, to shoot maybe both of those guys and retrieve the creature, because you can certainly see that X has the intention of retrieving the creature, because he's like, he looks at how much time is left. He's looking at the creature. So there is kind of the sense of that he's there for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know on whose behest he is there.
Right.
It's not entirely clear, because we know that he works for the syndicate as well. So it's always a little bit, and they were expecting that someone was going to come
right
for the train car. That was Mulder's whole plan.
Right. Right.
And no one else came but X. And
I like that idea that it was supposed, like that he had been sent, because we see him before, is it in what or not? We haven't seen it yet, but is it in Wet Wired when we first see him have a scene with Smoking Man, and where we kind of can assume that Smoking Man's sort of onto him?
I think so. Yeah.
I think it's in Wet Wired, which we will definitely have to talk about, because that was sort of kind of one of those half and half episodes.
Yeah.
But I get the feeling that like he is out doing his job, like on whatever the syndicate is sending him to do, but certainly not saving Mulder, because that's what the syndicate is telling him to do. You know, like he's there to do something else, and he makes the decision, okay, well, I'm here, for example, I'm here to blow up this train car. Let's say that's his job. Just annihilate it. Get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Everyone aboard, just trash. That's your job. Mm-hmm. But because it's X, he's like, well, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to save Mulder. And that feels right to me more than that he's just actually out there on his own volition.
Yeah, I agree. And then there does feel to me like there's like a moment of decision of, I only have time to save one creature here. It's either going to be this hybrid creature that I've been sent to save, or it's going to be Mulder. And so it's kind of like almost like a key moment, I think, for X, where we see, when it comes right down to it, who we really save, where are his allegiances. And at that moment, at least, he's on Mulder's side. And so it's very cool the way it's shot, that you can't see until sort of the last second about, you know, who is he taking, who's he carrying out of that exploding train car. And it's just a very sort of key dramatic moment. And, you know, X is always an interesting character. You never know what he's going to do. And so that's a very interesting sort of moment for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's the hero of the day in the end.
He really is. And I mean, especially considering, and I mean, we've talked about X before as just like a really cool, interesting informant. Might be one of my favorites. Because he's so begrudgingly helping Mulder. I mean, I think that's what makes him so interesting, is like he knows he sort of has to do this because it's the right thing to do. But at the same time, he would much rather not have to be doing it. And I like that about X. Whereas Deep Throat always felt like he was doing it because he felt guilty or because he wanted to do right. X, I'm not entirely clear on X's motives, but he certainly doesn't seem like he's doing this out of the kindness of his heart, if that makes sense.
No, I agree. And whereas I think Deep Throat, you could always sort of rely on him to try to do the right thing for Mulder. I never got that sense with X. He was much more unpredictable, much more sort of mercurial. You never quite knew what he was about. And so when he showed up in a scene, I always kind of felt like he could either be here to save Mulder, or he could either be here to murder Mulder. And I feel like he could do either one at any given moment, and it made him such an interesting character.
I mean, and I always am kind of sad that it's just yet another character that we had to say goodbye to too soon.
Yeah.
But the X-Files has to constantly keep it exciting on who's going to die next. So I get it.
They do. They keep it. They always keep it changing. They never stayed put for long.
Yeah. And that's what made it so great.
One of the many things.
Yeah. So one of the many things. Yes. So this last scene with Mulder and Scully, not a huge fan of this scene. I think it's we've had many better like final scenes with Mulder and Scully. And like I said, I feel like this scene could have been maybe rewritten to push that apology is policy like a little harder. I mean, I know he actually like literally says it in this scene, but again, it feels like it's not enough. I can't quite put my finger on it.
I feel like they're just kind of forcing the words into it. It's like,
yeah,
apology has become policy. And it just, I think it was Scully that said it. And it just feels very like, you're just saying that because it was the tagline, yeah, aren't you? It doesn't feel like a natural part of the conversation at all.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I do enjoy the continuity of Mulder's face having like complete shit kicked out of it. But
yeah,
it's kind of just like I don't know. These scenes where they kind of just turn up with nothing always, I mean, I get it. There, no one is more disappointed than them, but I always feel like, oh, they're back at the beginning again, which is where they want them. But at the same time,
It's kind of an interesting scene in the sense that they kind of, it reminds me a little bit of the end of Never Again in the sense that they kind of end at an impasse, not nearly on the same level of emotion as Never Again, but they basically kind of come to the conclusion that there are two different truths here.
Yeah.
And both of them want the truth to come out, but and both of them are passionate about the truth coming out. And both of them believe the government is hiding something nefarious, but they have very different ideas about what those things are. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the scene, they both feel the same way. Neither has convinced the other.
Yeah.
And they're both kind of stuck.
Yeah.
It's just kind of one of those sort of moments, which is always kind of interesting, I think, between Scully and Mulder, that, you know, they have this, you know, amazing relationship, but there's always, you know, a lot of impasses between them just because of, you know, the nature of their belief system. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those things just don't get resolved. A lot of times they don't. But you know what? They just kind of like they move on one way or the other.
Yeah.
They don't feel the need to keep hammering at it and hammering at it, trying to convince the other of their beliefs. It's kind of like, well, this is what I believe. Well, this is what I believe. Well, then, let's stare at each other and think about it for a while.
Stare at each other longingly. They are the epitome of agree to disagree because totally. They have to. Like, it's just, it's part of their MO. Like, we have to get to this point where we can move forward and agree to disagree. Another Absolutely. Thing you brought up Never Again, which is, I think, a really good example. But I think another really good example of an episode that sort of ends on a similar note is the season 6 opener, The Beginning. Because they have a very similar sort of tense conversation at the end of that about what's the truth, what they can prove. And, you know, there's already some tension in there in that scene. Yeah. But I think of that one a lot, too, when I think of a point where they have reached an impasse. And that, you know, that was an impasse paired with the added tension of Diana Fally, which we always have to give her a name drop just to give you a wonderful evening.
Thanks.
Jen.
Yeah, that goes my blood pressure. But yeah, I agree. It's a this is probably in 731, the least emotional of those impasses.
Yeah.
It's just more of like an intellectual disagreement,
exactly.
Although each are passionate about their beliefs, but there's not like, you know, personal issues underlying it the way there are in The Beginning and in Never Again.
And that's true, and that actually makes sense because those issues aren't present yet. Like, those issues arrive on time in their relationship,
yes, exactly.
At the right times in their relationship. And I feel like it's a really interesting progression. But yeah, this is sort of a type of ending that we get occasionally, where we're left just as frustrated as they are. And
it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tough ending.
But I do enjoy, more than that scene, I do enjoy this last scene with the stolen files and they're being copied over and then the reveal of Smoking Man for the first time, right?
Yeah, in the whole two-parter.
Yeah, I mean, it's just chef's kiss, man. It's great. It's such a great way to end this episode because
it's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering that Scully Mulder scene was just slightly lackluster. Like, if they had ended it on that, I would have been like, oh, that was lame. But then we go to this and I'm like, oh shit, like I had almost forgot he existed this entire episode.
Shit, you thought you weren't gonna get Cigarette Smoking Man in a myth arc? Here he is.
Yeah.
Boom.
One
I suspect
scene.
I probably squealed with delight when he showed up on screen.
I imagine most files do every time he shows up on screen. It's just
very
exciting.
Good. It's always good.
But I do have a technical question. So these files are clearly the ones that were taken from the train that Mulder was trying to get.
Dr. Zama's files.
Zama's files.
Journal or whatever.
But who... what is actually happening here? Because Mulder and Scully already got a fake version. So I assume that it had been swapped out on the train. So
at some point it was swapped out. I think the way that the sort of the provenance of the
fake file,
fake file in the briefcase, in the fake briefcase, was the real briefcase was on the train. We know that for a fact because Mulder saw it. Mm-hmm. And then at some point before it wound up in his hands at the end, it was swapped. It came, according to Scully, the conductor supplied this briefcase to, I guess, the FBI. The FBI gave it to Scully, or some law enforcement did. So the point at which that briefcase was replaced, I don't know if we know for sure whether it was on the train. I just assumed it wasn't on the train because we never got an indication that there was another sort of sinister person there. So I was just kind of assumed
someone
it was
at
just
the FBI
somewhere,
could have done it too.
Somewhere like in the FBI or just at some point in that chain of evidence, someone swapped it out.
Okay. So given that, the fact that, okay, these ones here are clearly the real ones with Smoking Man, but what exactly is he doing here? Just having him translate or having him copy them over, or what? Like,
my understanding was that it was translation from a nefarious Japanese person.
And
I guess, you know, Cigarette Smoking Man is just hanging around watching him translate while he smokes. I mean, this is probably a pretty big job, that's a pretty big journal, but he just likes to hang out watching the translation happen.
I think he just loves to hang out and look evil. And I mean, he's good at it.
Yeah. So it's a great opportunity.
If it
and
ain't
the
broke,
lighting
don't
was terrific.
Fix it.
And yeah, it was so great. And obviously they feel like there's a lot of valuable information from Dr. Zama. And now it has fallen into the syndicate's hands, which was, you know, not Dr. Zama's intention. Speaking of Dr. Zama, I was always, I feel a little, I don't know if irked is the right word, but I feel like it's a lost opportunity that I never felt like I knew anything about Dr. Zama. I mean, we talked about him. I mean, we as in like people watching the episode, he's discussed throughout the episode. We see him a couple of times, very briefly, generally being killed in the end. But we don't learn anything about him. And considering how important he turns out to have been to Scully's abduction.
Yeah.
I remember watching this episode at the time and feeling the way I did when I watched Closure, which was, I don't feel like that's the answer because it doesn't feel quite big enough to me. And Dr. Zama came out of nowhere. We didn't know anything about him. You know, compare with like Victor Klemper in Paperclip, similar kind of character. He had about as much screen time as Dr. Zama did, but I feel like we got to know him a little bit as a character, you know.
Right.
He's got his orchids. He said some interesting things. I just wish that they had fleshed out Dr. Zama a little bit as a character.
Well, can I offer a counter theory here?
Please do.
And I know you might disagree with me, but I think one of the best things about Closure and about the resolution of Samantha's arc is the mundanity of it. Is that the right way of saying that word?
We'll go with it.
It is, you know, painfully boring in terms of exactly what we expect or what makes sense to have happened. And the idea that we do not know anything about this guy, I think makes it more like, does it really matter? Like, this is one of these faceless men, these government men who have taken control over Scully. And at the end of the day, it's this sort of unknown that makes it scary. So I think that the fact that we don't know anything about him and he's very, it makes it more mundane, which makes it more believable, which makes it, I think, more scary. That's my opinion.
I think that's a very compelling argument.
Well, thank you.
I think that sort of looking back on it now, I can kind of try to incorporate that point of view. I think at the time it just didn't feel like enough. I just, you know, just from a traditional storytelling standpoint, I expected it to be a little bit more of a kabloom reveal.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It's more interesting this way.
And it isn't like, it's not about him. I mean, who cares who this guy is? It clearly wasn't only him experimenting on her. It was probably a bunch of men. Yeah. He just happens to be the one she had a memory of. Mm-hmm. So I think him being fleshed out or into an actual character, I think, is just very unnecessary. Mm. Considering like the people at the end of the day who are really at the heart of terrorizing Scully is essentially Smoking Man, who we do know. So I mean, I can see what you're saying, and it's hard for me to kind of come at it from the perspective of having watched it at the time because I didn't get to. But I think the idea of this just being a faceless dude is more compelling than mm-hmm. giving him a personality.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's the unexpected choice, isn't it? That's not necessarily right. how storytelling goes. And that's probably why I was thrown at the time, that it wasn't this, like, you know, dramatic reveal. Mm-hmm. And I think it threw me off sufficiently that it was like years before I finally started to accept, oh, that actually was the truth of what happened to Scully. I kept thinking that can't possibly have been it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the X-Files, though. You know, it doesn't necessarily tell stories in a traditional expected way. And sometimes that can throw me as a viewer, because I didn't necessarily understand all of the X-File rules in terms of how the narrative unfolds, because it doesn't follow the same rules that other shows follow.
Yeah. And then I can see, though, how now you can look back on it and be like, okay, I see what they were kind of trying to do there. But at the time, you're probably like, wait, that's it? That's not exciting enough. Because, you're getting a lot of answers in
that
this
can't
episode.
Be right.
There's a lot of answers in this episode that you're actually getting, you know, whether they're correct answers or not, you're getting answers and you're able to put those pieces together, which I think is fascinating.
It's all there.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's 7:31, guys. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
I don't think so. I wanted to have my little rant about Dr. Zama there, and I'm glad that I did. And I appreciated your point of view, because that makes me feel better about the situation.
Oh, good.
And it's a very, very solid episode. I always sort of think of Nisei has a lot more sort of like setting things up, a lot of exposition, a lot of learning things, and then it all kind of clicks and comes together in 7:31. Like, Nisei is more of like a tell episode, and 7:31 is more of a show episode.
Yeah.
And they work together well, but I'm always going to be a bigger fan of 7:31. But the two-parter is a great one. It's always got to have a happy place in my heart.
Yeah, I think it's a solid two-parter. I really like it. And so far, I feel like they're doing a lot more in terms of the overall mythology. I feel like they're doing a lot more of these sort of quote unquote red herrings, or at least they're introducing mm-hmm. the idea that, hey, just because we're giving you answers, it doesn't mean that those are the truth. And I feel like the X-Files continues to do that. The truth is ever elusive. And I think obviously by design. And so, of course, as we continue through this, it's going to get more and more complex and more difficult to sort of keep a grasp on. But if you just kind of keep barreling ahead, Jen, and remember that not every little thread is going to mean something, I do think a lot of this at this point is still connecting for me.
Yeah. I was still very happy with the myth arc at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're starting to run out of episodes that I loved in the myth arc, but I definitely loved these two, so we'll see how I feel the next time we're discussing the mythology.
Okay. Wow. I mean, I thought the myth arc was strong all the way like through season 5, so I'll be interested to hear what you're going to be. Really, you're making faces. You don't like the cancer arc?
Am
you don't
I?
Like Tunguska Terma? You don't like season 4 mythology? Yikes.
I mean, I love the cancer arc, but we'll talk about Tunguska Terma when we get there. I don't dislike them. I just don't love them. Up until that point, I loved all the mythology episodes, and things started to just go slightly off the rails for me in terms of my emotional connection with the mythology.
Okay.
But you know, it may be different this time.
We'll
I'm
see.
Gonna really give it my very best shot and try to keep an open heart and open mind.
Okay. I love that. And yeah, we'll see that. I'm giving it a couple more seasons than you do before I think. Actually, I give it much more than you do. I give it a lot more seasons than you do. But we'll see.
I'm hoping to kind of get to that point myself.
Yeah, I love it. Because, I mean, this is great, being able to pick all of this apart in order this way. It's really fun.
Yeah. Because I'm not going to watch a lot of these episodes of my own volition. So it is good for me to make the effort.
Exactly. I love that. the sacrifices that we both make for the pod. I do enjoy that.
We do it.
Well, thanks you guys for listening, and please offer us your thoughts on the mythology and anything about these two episodes in general at XFD Podcast on Twitter, and we will see you back again next time with another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.